for the WNA's, the manager of waste management and RP working groups. He has 5 years decommissioning experience at the Magnatz reactors as a health physicist. He has a master's degree in physics. We'll start with our first presentation this morning. We'll keep the presentations and have a short question and answer session at the end of each of the sessions, then we'll summarize it at the end. And the first presentation is dose constraints for the Korean nuclear power plants, radioactive discharge associated with new nuclear build. The presenter is Mr. Jeong-in Kim. He's major in nuclear engineering and health physics at the Hanyang University in Korea. Has a master's degree from 2002. Has been working at the Radiation Health Research Institute for Korea Hydro and Nuclear Power Company since 2002. And he's a senior research scientist for the radiation safety of workers in the nuclear power plants.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Jeong-in Kim. I'm working at Radiation Health Research Institute of KHNP. The KHNP means Korea Hydro and Nuclear Power Company, operates 21 nuclear power plants in Korea, the whole nuclear power plant in Korea. So my topic is about the dose constraints for the Korean nuclear power plants. That means the dose constraints into the general public near the nuclear sites. That means it's which our company are faced with nowadays. So yes, as you know, the dose constraints for the workers and the general public can be set by the KHNP or the regulatory body. So those constraints should be lower than those limits by the 20 millisievert, the lower than 20 millisievert for the workers in nuclear power plants. And also the general public should be the dose constraints lower than 1 millisievert per year. So now we already set that those constraints for the workers below 20 millisievert. We set 16 millisievert per year. The other name we called it operational limits. So and the general for the dose constraints for general public, but it should be set by the KINS. KINS means Korea Institute of Nuclear Safety, the Korea regulatory body. That they should set the dose constraints for general public below the 1 millisievert. But the dose constraint means for the general public, the dose which will be used for designing and planning level, not the operational level. So that's the target, what I said, this presentation. Yes, we already set those limits for the radiation, those constraints for the radiation workers were already set. But and those constraints for general publics were also set about 10 years ago to 0.25 millisievert per year. So, but this 0.25 millisievert is rather so tight. So now we should try to adjust those constraints. We cannot adjust those constraints. We just adjust how those should be estimated. The method that means we are now reviewing how the method for calculation of the dose from discharge. From now, we just consider the maximum and extreme case. But using this type of method, we cannot match the 0.25 millisievert. So now we should change the method, the dose to the general public near the nuclear sites. Yes, as you see, this is right. The value is the real dose, real estimated dose to the general public in the nuclear sites. We have a major four nuclear sites: Yongguang, Kuri, Waesong, Uljin. Each nuclear site has 4 to 6 units there, but the dose is almost 0.00 0.01, that means 10 microsieverts per year, is by the real discharge from the nuclear sites. But those constraints, 0.20 millisievert, is rather higher than the actual dose to the general public. Yes, but the problem is when we design a new nuclear power plant in the same place, the multiple nuclear facilities can be added a new the dose to the general public. Then we should consider the extreme cases in designing level, so it can be exceed the 0.20 millisievert per year. Yes, so you can see that in Gori site, they already operate six nuclear power plants there, but we will add it called Shin-Gori, that means new nuclear power plant in Gori site, with that the estimated dose to the general public is 0.131 millisievert per year. And also the new Shin-Gori site 3 and 4 is 0.197 millisievert per year. It's almost the level of 0.25 millisievert per each site. That means we added more than new nuclear power plants. It can exceed the dose constraint 0.25 millisievert. Our plan is, you can see that our plan of the new build by 2024. So we have Wuljin and Welsung and Gori site, but one of the solutions is to make another new set of new nuclear site. But as you know, to set the new nuclear site is a very big problem, because because the general public was they don't want to nuclear power plant in their areas. Moreover, from the situation of the situation, the situation is very, very difficult to set a new nuclear site in Korea. So the only way to can solve this problem is just to add the nuclear power plants in the previous site, right? So we should add it more than 4 or 8 new nuclear power plant or Wuljin, Welsung, and Gori site. We also operate the nuclear power plants there, more than 5 or 6 nuclear power plants. So if we operate more than 10 nuclear power plants will be operated, we can not match the dose constraint 0.25 millisieverts. So our hope and our target is to make 0.25 millisievert to only 0.5 millisievert per year. It's just our target, but I think it's with very tiny values to compare with the dose limit of general public. So we have now do our best to change to match the 0.25 millisievert, but those constraints. So as you know, those constraints should be set by the one radiation source. So we define each nuclear site cannot be defined only one source. So we divide it by 2 or 3 or 4 sources, then we can match the 0.25 millisievert dose constraints for the general public of each site. And another solution is that we in designing level, we should estimate how much dose should be delivered to the general public in the nuclear site. Then, in previous estimation, we considered the very extreme case, but now we should change it. It's not extreme case, it's just average case, or that means it can be lowerized estimate those to the general public in designing level. Yeah, the another, yes, you know, the optimization of the radiation dose to the workers is should be done because the actually the ICRP wants, ICRP recommended that they want to lowerize the dose to the workers in nuclear power plants. But as you see, the for the general public, the dose constraints for the general public is not should, is not the dose limit. If we apply the dose constraint to the general public, it can be another dose limit. So the 1 millisievert is no more meanings to nuclear power plants. So if we set the 0.25 millisieverts per dose constraints for general public, then the 0.25 millisieverts will be a dose limit for the to our KHNP. So you can see the actual or annual dose 100 millisievert is not confirmed just apply the RNT hypothesis. That means the lower dose is just for the hypothesis. So our suggestion is the dose about more dose to the general public should not be the limit to manage the general public to people who live in near the nuclear site. So what 1 millisievert per year just to the one man about the 100,000 persons, that means it's a very tiny value to so we cannot consider that it will be real risk to the general public. So we think that no meaning for the more scientific research to set up those constraints in range of those limit. This table shows the how much instance can be accrued to the general public for the new cancers by the additional irradiation. So you can see if you set the 1 millisievert per year, the instance can be raised by maximum 5% to thyroid cancer, and if we set 0.25 millisievert per year, it's just for below than 1% is very tiny value. So what I want to say is just those constraints to the general public is not so great meaning to the for the safe of the general public in the nuclear sites. So I think we should consider the more higher value to apply this new nuclear build to design the new nuclear build. So the dose constraint should be more higher than nowadays set 0.25 millisievert or 0.3 millisievert. It should be bigger than much more, like 1 millisievert or higher. That's what I have to say. Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, John Kim. I'd like to, for the presentation, I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions from the audience.
Yes. Excuse me, public, how to set a method. Yeah, so the method is very so complicated, but we consider the person who live in the very critical situations. So At first, we estimate in extreme case, somebody who live in the over the sea, yeah, that's absurd. So we now change the person. When in nuclear site there are not many people there, so we can we should consider the people who really live in the site. Yeah? So the estimated dose to dose by dose from the nuclear power plant can be lowerized in designing. Yeah. Well, actually, in designing, the dose to the general public more about 0.1 millisievert per year. But if we change that kinds of the situation, it's lowerized about 60%.
Other comments or questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I will move to the next presentation. And this is by Marcel Lips, Radiation Protection for an Emergency and Industry Perspective. Marcel works for the Goshen Nuclear Power Plant since 1991. He's currently the head of the Department of Chemistry and Radiation Protection. In addition, he's responsible for emergency preparedness. He's involved in waste management. He's currently a member of the National Cooperative for the Disposal of Radioactive Waste Technical Committee and Board of Directors for Central Interim Storage Facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to present on the emergency issue and how such an item has been introduced in an existing plant. These are the items I'm going to talk about. First, I'll give you a brief repetition on the international requirements, especially on the emergency topic, and for those that are maybe not so familiar with. Then I'm going to show you how these requirements have been implemented in an existing plant, at the specific case of the Goshen nuclear power plant in Switzerland. Then I'm going to compare the theoretical framework with real life, and finally I will draw my conclusions. Chapter 4 of the BSS addresses the emergency preparedness, setting a few general requirements, each containing a couple of items. The first one, it's on a very generic level, focusing on responsibilities, on training, on plans and action plans, just to mention the most important ones. Basically, this could be applied to other industries like an airline company or chemical industry as well. The next one addresses specifically the planning stage and contains a set of triggers to be applied during the emergency response. The objective is really to develop several strategies in order to get an optimized, justified response and to protect people from radiation injuries. The focus is on the general public, setting the reference levels. The third requirement is directed towards the emergency workers. The focus is on dose limits and on voluntariness. And the last one, it's directed to the post-emergency situation. It's not so urgent on the timeline and addresses the issue on dose limits for workers and acceptable doses to the population. So far, these requirements from the radiation protection point of view. Besides the BSS, there are many other documents addressing the emergency issue from different point of views. I just show you up here two other examples of IAEA documents, but there are others coming from international organizations. I won't go through all of them, otherwise I would run out of time. But I want to underline with this that radiation protection is not the only issue when dealing with an emergency response. There are many, many other factors to be considered. I'll turn now to my second part, which shows the implementation at the specific example. As in all other countries, I guess in Switzerland, the international requirements are the basis for national legislation, where from there the authorities derive the requirements for us and we have to implement them in our internal rules and documents. An emergency situation, it might be a technical issue, as you can see on the left side of this slide. It might be a violence against your installations or even anything different. And according to the international requirements, we have defined a whole set of different emergency situations, each with specific action plans which are optimized, justified on the design basis of the power plant and even beyond that on different strategies and possible strategies in the beyond design and severe accident regime. Please take note that only a minor part of these different situations are directly linked to radiation protection. Other ones may have subsequent RP consequences, of course, but some of them, they have no radiation protection relevance. This is an approach I often miss a little bit in the RP community, which is focusing too much on the radiation protection issue. It's the same for me, and I feel that also the BSS is very strong RP-oriented. Of course, it's an RP document, but as I told you, there are many, many other aspects to be considered. Balancing with other emergency criteria, that was a finding that was also made by another presenter Tuesday morning during the Fukushima session. At the administrative level, we covered a whole set of emergency situations with the framework, with the emergency regulations. Beginning from, and please understand me correctly, beginning from the simple, heavily insured person going through the design accidents, beyond design, or even severe accidents. At the lower level, on the procedures, whereas we have a set of different procedures, specific procedures, to deal with the situation we are, or we don't hope to be once in. When we respond to an emergency situation, we have installed an organization which is shown on this slide. You don't need to just to read everything. But I want to point out that at the top level, the emergency superintendent, which is normally the plant manager, he is the responsible person. He is supported by his chief of staff, who organizes all the tasks. He's supported from by the Piquet engineer and several sections of emergency groups, most of them containing additional groups. In total, I can fall back to about 200 employees within this organization. And as long as line management is still available, I can even go further and can fall back on nearly the entirement of the staff working at the plant. Depending a little bit on the situation, we reduce that organization to the essential sections needed. Or In the other case, we even can expand it, adding additional internal elements or even external elements. Here again, you can see RP is only one of the players. The RP section is certainly, let me say, the watchdog for the limits and RP business, which is in our case in compliance with international requirements. But RP is not always the key player in the superior level of decision making. Beyond that, at the national level, we work together with different response partners, each of them with definite roles of responsibility. Our duty as an operator is the on-site response. It's to give information on current plant status and on possible developments of the emergency, and especially also on the source term. The latter, combined with meteorological data, serves then to forecast radiation dispersion predictions. This is done by the authority. And from these models, then, governmental organizations define and implement protective actions. Exercises, sometimes with all these partners, are performed on a regular basis. These are inspected at least once a year by our authorities. And to conclude that part, all in all, I can say we are quite well positioned in the emergency preparedness item and in compliance with the international regulations. The question is now, how does this fit into practice? And this leads me now to my third part. Everything begins with this small, mousy word. Within seconds, you are confronted with a huge set of questions. Of course, it always happens when you don't expect it. And you're lucky. I repeat, you are lucky when the situation escalates like you have planned it. But is this reality? I guess you all know Captain Sullenberger and his famous emergency landing on the Hudson River. An emergency landing on the river in between tall houses where several bridges cross the river, where you have hundreds of boats, and I don't know what else, is certainly not an optimized planning stage. But it happened. Sullenberger had only a few seconds left to decide. He had no time to consult any emergency procedures. And 2 minutes later, it was not optimized, but the lucky end. I could explain much more of such examples also from the nuclear industry, no problem, but again, I would really run out of time. The point is, and this is my main message, the point is you can optimize your planning and your preparedness as long as you can. Of course, improving always your preparedness, but reality might be different. And you won't be any longer in compliance with the system. My view, the approach given in the BSS is quite theoretical in that view and poses some concern. Now, I come back to my slide. A part of all these questions here, there is a big demand of information coming from different institutions. And there is a need of information coming from different places. But at the beginning of an incident or an emergency, Well, you even know more or less nothing. You even don't see your mousy word any longer. But you have to decide on your response strategy. And that's the big issue all the times you deal with emergency. And I really wonder if under such circumstances the choice of your strategy is always the best one. Last month I was at the seminar of the Swiss Federal Commission on Radiation Protection, where a representative of JIEC in Japan reported on emergency preparedness in a severe nuclear accident following the Fukushima accident. And there were many interesting points for improvement, even for us. But when we were told that during the evacuation, 50 people died from different non-radiation reasons, one could raise the question, could these 50 lives have been saved? The decision to evacuate the general public in order to prevent a certain amount of exposure, which is the trigger, so-called trigger, according to the BSS, that was consistent with the requirement and optimized according to the plans. And I think the right decision at the moment, because you didn't know how your system escalates. But probably, in the aftermath, it was not the best choice. So there is a gap here in between the theory and reality. What you can see here on the next slide is a paragraph from an INPO report issued last November on the Fukushima accident. It's the description of a team response to open a valve to vent the containment of one of these units. The response failed because of the dose limit. I don't know the exact situation, but maybe the time loss to vent the containment could have worsened the situation at the plant. I raise this question especially in the light of another IAEA document, also dealing with emergencies. And this document says up to about 200 millisieverts, you need tens of thousands of people to increase the detectable incidence rate of cancer. So for me now, as an operator, on the one hand, I have the 50 millisievert limit in the BSS, maybe on less. And on the other hand, I see a document from the same institution saying, well, up to 200 millisievert, it's not the big issue. So it's contradicting a little bit. And I wonder why we set such low numbers in the BSS, maybe hindering an effective response. And just to remember you, 50 millisievert, not for one incident, but in a year, 50 millisievert in a year is within the variation of natural background radiation, at least in my country. Let me raise a second question. I was told by my Japanese colleagues this week that this was not an issue. Well, that's the good news. But what if? I personally can't come into a situation to be the superintendent in emergency case. When my plant manager is not on the site, well, then it's me. And then I will be responsible. I will have to decide on the strategy, even knowing nothing at the beginning. And our strategies, they rely on the organization I showed you before, and they don't rely on volunteers. I could not imagine just talking to a member of the fire brigade saying, oh, you see, we have our reactor on fire. well, the response is optimized, but you may get 60 millisieverts. Would you please be so kind and help me? Emergency response doesn't work in this way. And I do not know any emergency organization based on volunteers in certain circumstances. This is quite a point of big concern for us as operators. Then I want just to raise a last issue, the transition from normal operation to an emergency situation into an existing situation. You see the dose limits, they can vary between by a factor of 20 or even 100. Now imagine you are not an RP expert. You are a member of the public reading things like that. That's the answer. The current system covers a wide range of situations and sources. Normal operation, emergency, post-emergency, existing, artificial, medical, natural, and so on. And defines a set of different numbers, maybe huge different numbers, that a member of the public cannot develop a feeling if the situation is safe or not. We've heard that also during the Fukushima session on Tuesday and this morning. And there is even disagreement among experts, because I'm sure not everybody in here agrees what I have said in the last minute. So it might be a challenge for the whole RP community to further develop the system which will be understood. We should pick up this along the lines of living with radiation and engaging with society. Probably the rejection of the overly conservative numbers might be a first step. Personally, I'm convinced that would raise the acceptance of the nuclear industry. So now that brings me to my conclusions. History has showed that emergency preparedness is a very important issue. The better you are prepared, the better your response is. But be aware, the response is not often exactly as you have prepared it. So you need to be flexible. And each event around the world helps us to improve, of course. Emergency preparedness is not only an RP issue. I see a need for a more superior perspective. RP numbers are not always consistent in the framework and unnecessarily low, maybe really hindering a response. One should think about. And the last point, the system of RP is incomprehensible to the general public and raises discussions and makes fear. This is not a quite good situation, especially for us in the nuclear industry. Well, that's all. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marcel, for your presentation on emergency preparedness. At this point in time, I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions to Marcel. Marcel, and you said you had approximately 200 people and you run periodic drills. How often do you run those drills at Ghost?
The exercises?
The exercises.
Well, we run one each year, which is also inspected by the authorities, and we run 2 to 3 other exercises internally.
And you're a single unit site?
We are a single unit site, yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else have any comments or questions?
Well, if not, I stay in the audience until the end. So. Right.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marcel. I'd like to move on to our next presentation. It is Tissue Reactions and Non-Cancer Effects by Shinichiro Mazakai. He's currently the manager, or was the manager of Radiation Protection Sector at Kansai from 1999 to 2010. He was the chair of the WNA, World Nuclear Association Radiation Protection Working Group from 2005 to 2010. And he's now working with the Nuclear Engineering Limited to improve the RP system.
Thank you, Chairman. My presentation is challenges to the future system of radiation protection. ICRP published a draft report for consultation in January 2011 regarding tissue reaction non-cancer. So it might bring a big impact to the current radiation protection system. So we must. I believe this issue is very important for us. So the purpose to influence the current movement by the international RP community that support a reduction of those limit for tissue reaction by at least half. And next purpose is retain a strong scientific basis for the system of RP in contrast to ICRP draft publication on tissue reactions. First of all, concerns regarding publication. The understanding of epidemiological result from atomic bomb survivors. ICRP started the discussion based on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki epidemiological data. Basically, talking about epidemiological data in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are two basic databases. One is adult health study, and another is lifelong lifespan studies. If we want to discuss the instance like described in ICRP draft report, we should deal the data from the adult health study. So, should consider data from the adult health study. It's one point. And second point is a methodology of risk analysis, risk estimate, and the mechanism. Threshold doses for tissue reactions based on 1% instance. It's described in ICRP draft report. A stochastic limit based on 5% mortality rate. How to make clear the relationship between risk of instance and mortality? That should be defined. The third point is mechanisms of tissue reactions. Do we have enough biological data? Even now, we have the amount of biological data, but most of the biological data regarding tissue reaction is done rather high dose or dose rate. Can we validly extrapolate effect from high dose rate to the low dose rate region? So, for these concerns, we should counter proposal. We should make the counter proposals for promoting the positive discussion. One is a promote understanding of epidemiological data from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Even a circulatory disease, there are many kinds of disease. A circulatory disease contains many kinds of disease, so promote a specific analysis of each type of circulatory disease. And second, discuss, clarify the relationship between incidence and mortality. Discussion of threshold is needed for defining the risks. How to find the risk regarding tissue reaction non-cancer should be needed. And risk for tissue reaction and cataract should be examined separately. Basically, tissue reactions, especially cardiovascular or cerebrovascular disease, that kind of tissue reaction and cataract should be divided. The reason is basically the mechanism of these reactions are totally different. And third point is discuss concept of cell killing, severity, and non-targeted effect. Recent biological findings outside of Europe suggest more data and discussion are needed. We will discuss more precisely, so the specific data regarding non-cancer will be opened by ourselves in the next RP working group meeting, which will be held in the middle of this September. So see you in London. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions. Okay, seeing none. Move to the next presenter. Specifically, it'll be the uranium miners review of radon by John Takala. He's currently the Director of Safety, Health, Environment, and Quality Systems of Cameco Corp. Cameco Corp operates uranium mines, mills, conversion, and fuel fabricating facilities in Canada, and also uranium mines in the United States and Kazakhstan. John started his career in radiation protection as a health physicist. Particular areas of focus have been radon, internal dosimetry, design of new facilities, including high-grade underground mines, integrated management systems, and safety culture.
Thank you. I'll be presenting the uranium mining industry's views on the recent ICRP statement and publications on radon. I'll start off talking a little bit about our WNA, the World Nuclear Association Working Group that we have. The core of my talk will be on our views on the ICRP publications and statements on radon. I'll start off with the epidemiological results and move on to the dosimetric approach that's been proposed. And then I'll talk about what we're doing in industry going forward. First, a bit about our working group. The WNA has a number of technical groups that deal with issues of common interest to its members company. A specific task group from the uranium mining companies has been organized to address current issues about radon, and our companies operate around the world from southern Africa to the northern Canada, Central Asia, Australia, and the United States, and we account for most of the world's uranium production. Our task group is focused on the ICRP statement on radon that was published in late 2009, and then there's been couple of publications since then, one talking about the dose conversion factor for radon progeny is likely to increase in light of the updated epidemiological results, and then the ICRP's intent to adopt a dosimetric approach for radon progeny. And I'll talk about both of these separately. With regard to the updated epidemiological evidence, the ICRP has stated the risk from radon has doubled. So practically, the doubling would change the dose conversion per unit exposure currently at 5 millisieverts per working level month to something around 10 millisieverts per working level month. And we're certainly supportive of using the latest epidemiological results But we do note that there's some need for further clarity on a few issues. In particular, the underlying population characteristics are very important, especially with regard to smoking, as this is a dominant risk for lung cancer. In the recent ICRP report on radon and lung cancer, we heard that risk from radon is on the order of 20 times greater for smokers than non-smokers. And we put this against a general trend of declining smoking rates, as seen on the last slide. Doug Chambers had this slide up from data he'd pulled from WHO reports. He presented this earlier in the week. And you see from the 90s to 2005 time frame, a clear downward trend in smoking rates. And most countries on the graph are now below 30%. There's similar data showing a decreasing trend in the number of cigarettes smoked. And this is good news and should eventually impact average risks from radon. Doug Chambers has looked at the sensitivity of the dose conversion factors to different smoking rates using different published risk models, and he went into this in a little bit more detail earlier in the week. And the median result for a nominal 30% smoking rate was about 6 to 7 millisieverts per working level month, compared to the current value of 5 millisieverts per working level month, so not too far off. And given the trend of a decreasing smoking rate, we'd expect to see decreasing population average lung cancer risk from radon in the future. Against this backdrop, we see the current value of 5 millisieverts per working level month as quite protective for non-smokers. In addition, we considered doubling the current value to be a very conservative approach. It's also important to note that the current levels of radon progeny in uranium mines are generally quite well optimized and have been significantly lowered in comparison to the historical cohorts through which we derive most of our risks from radon through the ongoing process of optimization. So summarizing the epidemiological issue, we'd ask that consideration be given to what constitutes a nominal population, particularly in terms of smoking. Moving on to the dosimetric approach, industry believes that its adoption is slightly premature at this time, and a couple of issues need to be addressed. First, a clear validation of the model. Related to this, it's not clear how the dosimetric model deals with smoking. And then there are practical issues, the lack of field data, and the lack of accepted measurement protocol. Overall, industry understands the ICRP preference for using a dosimetric model and support this as a longer-term goal. And I'll touch on these points in a bit more detail. We believe that further work is needed on the validation of the dosimetric model before it is applied in real-world conditions. Expressed as a question, is the apparent agreement between the average dose conversion factor from the epidemiological studies and the typical dosimetric parameters coincidence? What has been used as a tip for typical mine conditions is not representative of any particular historical mine. So can the dosimetric model explain some of the variations we see in the risks from radon between the different historical miner cohorts? And so along this line, we believe that that would be a good test to apply the dosimetric model to some of these historical cohorts. May be possible. We recognize this will be challenging for many cases, but may be possible for some. Note the Ontario miner cohort, which is planned to be updated in the next few years. This may be possible to do. It's not clear how the dosimetric model deals with smoking. For default inputs of a non-smoker, one would expect the results of the dosimetric model to be several times lower than the mixed population results from the epidemiology studies. Recent paper by Bias showed about a difference of 2 between the non-smokers and smokers using the dosimetric model, which is considerably less than the approximate factor of 20 noted by the ICRP. These comments on the dosimetric model really and smoking are related to the efficacy of the dosimetric model, not so much as the use of the nominal population average risk. And this, borrowing another slide from Doug's presentation, just shows this. Here's from the range you see of the risk from the smoker to non-smoker from the epidemiology, and then looking at the dosimetric approach, non-smoker here to the heavy long-term smoker, about a factor of 2 versus 20. Our last point relates to the lack of relevant field data in a measurement protocol. There's been little work in the area of measuring radon progeny aerosols over the last couple of decades. Over this time, there's been many changes to mining technology and uranium mining in particular. And many of these changes have improved general industrial hygiene conditions, and new sources of uranium has arisen, such as in-situ recovery mining. Industry, and we believe most regulators, have little ability to collect data in the short term, measured over the next couple of years. We believe that a standard measurement protocol is needed, and it needs to be practical in the challenging conditions of a mine. We want to be able to confidently compare results across our operations around the world. So we think that more work is needed to validate the model, and we look to the ICRP for leadership in this area. In addition, we need to improve the knowledge of radon progeny aerosol conditions in current workplaces, and industry strongly recommends deferring the adoption of the dosimetric approach until this work is completed. Looking ahead, industry is organized through the WNA to tackle the issue of measuring radon progeny aerosol conditions. We're working with consultants, Doug Chambers and others, to develop a standard measurement protocol that'll survive the rigors of the mines. And our goal is to have some publishable quality result over the next few years, and perhaps at next IRPA conference, we'll be presenting some of this data. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for your presentation on radon. I'd like to open it up for any comments or questions from the audience. Don't see any comments or questions. Again, thanks, John. I'll just quickly summarize some of the discussions we had this morning and then open it up to just see if anybody has any other final comments. We heard this morning about dose constraints and the general public for the Korean nuclear power plants and a proposal to look to raise the current dose constraint for the members of the general public due to the issues it's creating for the new construction. And currently this basis is on the high performance was achieved over decades through optimization for the current dose limits, and the current resulting doses are much lower than would pose a real health concern for the members of the public and the environment. We also heard a radiation protection discussion for an emergency, an industry perspective from Goskin, talked to several key points around emergency preparedness is important and needs to be developed continuously. Emergency preparedness is a multi-dimensional issue, and a narrow focus on radiation protection aspects can be misleading. And the system of RP covering the different types and sources of radiation raises discussion amongst experts and is not clearly understood by the public, and that's a point that we need to continuously work on as radiation protection professionals. Talked about future challenges in the radiation protection program and some specific concerns regarding the data and specific the impact to the tissue reactions and the non-cancer effects. and a discussion around to promote an understanding of the epidemiological data, discuss and clearly define the relationship between incident mortality, and then discuss the concepts of cell killing and finalize those discussions. And then final presentation this morning was on uranium miners utility industry views on the ICRP statement and a need and concern around the impacts of smoking and the risk from radon and need to be explained in a further transparent manner. I guess primarily then while the industry supports an improvement in the methodology of estimating doses from radon, more work is needed on the dosimetric approach to validate the model and better understand its practical implications. So those are what I would summarize as the key points coming out of the presentations. And with that, I would like just to offer it up if there are any final comments or questions from members of the audience. Seeing none, I'd like to thank our presenters for their presentations this morning and thank the audience for their attendance. And that concludes the session. Thank you.